Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What comes to mind when somebody mentions Southern cooking? While heirloom recipe books might contain recipes for biscuits smothered in gravy, sticky sweet marshmallow salads, and lots of deep-fried batter, it is possible to prepare meals that are equally Southern in flavor but are centered in a thoroughly modern way around ingredients like just-picked produce and fresh-caught fish. There are few guests more versed in both traditional and new Southern cooking than my guests, Matt Lee and Ted Lee. They're contributing editors to Travel and Leisure and wine columnists for Martha Stewart Living. Their first cookbook won the James Beard Cookbook of the Year Award in 2007, and they've just published a new collection called the Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern, Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. They're in town for a signing event tonight at 7 at Legacy Books in Plano. Guys, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. Great to be here.
What do people misunderstand about Southern food?
Oh, gosh.
Where
to begin with that one? I think there are two principal misunderstandings about food.
Southern food.
First, that it's very difficult to prepare, and secondly, that it's all bad for you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure where those misperceptions come from, and certainly they describe plenty of things that are out there. I mean, it's really hard to do a whole hog barbecue or put on an oyster roast for 200 people the way we do in the Lowcountry where we're from. But with the new book, we really wanted to take those misconceptions head on and say you really can cook Southern food tonight with fresh ingredients and, you know, make healthy Southern food.
Yeah, a lot of this stuff is ready in like half an hour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was an outgrowth, actually, of the first book. In the first book, where we went long on everything, I mean, we covered the entire South. We presented the full diversity of Southern food experience, including sort of historic and epic gumbos with, you know, 28 ingredients and that took all weekend to prepare, that kind of thing. We did key 40 out of 220 recipes were coded quick knockouts, and those were ones that we felt, you know, sort of were a respite from that epic type of Southern cooking. And on the road touring with the first cookbook and doing cooking demonstrations, lo and behold, we found out that people really loved those quick knockouts. And things like we had an appetizer dip called butterbean pate, which is basically a hummus for chips or you know, crudité made from butter beans, buttermilk, olive oil, lemon, salt, and pepper. Really simple, buzzed in a blender. And when we did a book signing, we'd take that dip to almost every book signing just to have something for people to sample. People loved it. And they also loved cooking it. We heard, you know, the feedback we got was like, gosh, this is like my new standby, you know, when I have guests coming over, cocktail hour, that kind of thing. It's just nice to roll out, you know, the fresh flavors of summer. Oh, I forgot to mention it's got mint and parsley in it, mm-hmm. Tons of it. So it's a really bright sort of summery, end of summer flavor and something you can conjure up year round because the butter beans are available in the just baby lima beans you can use available in the freezer section. What? So we compiled a whole cookbook of these quick knockouts. That's what Simple Fresh Southern really is.
Yeah, one thing that's really cool about this is that you went through your whole collection of classic old cookbooks and then found the things that actually worked and dispensed with some of the things that don't feel very modern.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. I mean, we love old Southern cookbooks, and we have a huge collection of them. But you do find in a lot of, especially the mid-century books, great ideas, but the execution tends to be sort of lacking, or certainly in the Depression era, you can sort of sense that in the book itself, because they'll leave things out, or they'll be very parsimonious with ingredients that we use plentifully today. But the one we mentioned in the introduction to this book was just
hilarious.
A kind of hilarious recipe for shrimp and deviled egg casserole. And, you know, it was like a 3-hour-long recipe that involved making an entire, you know, 24 deviled eggs and then sluicing them with a shrimp gravy and buttered breadcrumbs on top of that.
Layer upon layer.
And you ate this so we didn't have to, essentially.
Right. Well, it was sort of a disaster of a recipe, but the genius at the core of that recipe was this marriage of shrimp and deviled eggs, which, you know, we love deviled eggs, we love shrimp, and we like the idea of making something out of that combination, that pairing, And what we came up with was, you know, basically a very light shrimp salad where the deviled part of the egg, the yolk mixed with the mustard and your curry and your hot sauce, is the binding of a shrimp and an egg salad, basically. And we load it in a top-loading bun the way you would, the way that Northeasterners do with a lobster roll. Mm-hmm. And so it was sort of, those are the kind of the twists that we bring to our takes on old Southern recipes.
You do write here about the thriftiness that is inherent even today in mm-hmm. Southern cooking, and even the idea of if you make something with shrimp, you hang onto the shells and
sure.
you make a broth.
Sure.
You know, there's a cleverness in the kitchen that we find when we cook with other Southerners of all ages, and I think you find it as well. You can read it in the recipes and the cookbooks that we've encountered, and it's the one thing that we point to, a sort of spirited resourcefulness that's very Southern. And I like to use the word clever now because resourcefulness, you know, sounds sort of Depression era, you know, MacGyver, you know, cobbling things together. But it's really just a sense of joy in the kitchen that Southerners love food, love to build big flavors and lots of layers of flavor, elements of, you know, tangy, salty, sweet, all in one bite. And we try to harness that in even the most simple thing, like we've got a chilled tomato soup. You know, what could be more basic? You know, I just think of like the stuff coming out of the soup can. But we build one out of fresh tomatoes, and the layers of flavor come from things like, in an ingredient sense, the use of smoked paprika is just, it's now available everywhere. It used to be an esoteric gourmet ingredient, but it's just a tiny little element that adds a nice layer of flavor and smoke, which is another Southern characteristic in our book. And then there's a technique element, which is that, you know, when you slice into a fresh tomato, there are those sort of seed cavities with the jelly-like, they almost look like, you know, frog eyeballs or something like that.
That's appetizing.
Really appetizing, and it's really good to get rid of those seeds in a certain sense. What we do is we put those seeds, we collect them and put them in just a simple mesh strainer and tap that strainer against your hand. And what happens is, over a period of just 15 seconds or so, the vibrations make the gel turn to liquid, and you save that juice. And that juice turns out to be the key to that fresh, summery, fresh tomato flavor. And so you add that back in with the tomato pulp, and it you know, just boosts makes the tomato flavor bolder and more wonderful. It's just a little simple, not difficult trick that you can use to boost flavor in the kitchen.
Ted Lee and Matt Lee are my guests. Their new book is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. You start the book out with drinks, and I was surprised to see a variation on what we in college called trash can punch.
PJ.
PJ.
The purple Jesus is what you call it.
It appears, you know, we've been traveling around the Southeast, and it appears that every town has its own name for this thing. But it's basically,
I think in Oxford, Mississippi, it's called purple Jesus, and someone told us about it. We weren't in a Southern fraternity ever, and so we had to learn about this secondhand. But yeah, it's a trash can hooch, and it's often purple. Probably flavored by a powdered drink mix. And we decided, as we do with so many things that have all the fun that we want to harness but not quite enough flavor or culinary integrity to them, we reverse engineer them into something that adults can eat or
yours
drink.
Yours is Kool-Aid free.
Ours is totally Kool-Aid free. Not that we have anything against Kool-Aid, but we wanted to give people who do have something against Kool-Aid an option. Mm-hmm. And the option is to marinate fresh fruits, and especially like black cherries and blackberries, which we consider very Southern, in the liquor, vodka, you know, Everclear, whatever it happens to be. And we played around. We did a lot of experimentation, actually, and, you know, that was fun, with different fruits. And pink grapefruits, you know, good Texas grapefruits play a role in this beverage now in our version. And you come up with this wonderful, well-balanced, like bitter, sweet. There might even be a pinch of salt in there. Salt, as it turns out, and we describe this in the drinks chapter, is really crucial for taking your drinks to the next level. Just a little pinch helps round out the flavors and makes everything pop. But anyhow, we love to have fun with the drink section, that's for sure.
And you mentioned this stuff called celery syrup, which sounds like a really interesting component to things.
Yeah. And the celery syrup was sort of inspired by a drink that we encountered. It was celery soda and bourbon. And we love bourbon, being Southern. And we just thought it was a great combination. But celery soda is not easy to find. So we developed a celery syrup, which is basically celery seeds toasted in the skillet to make them very fragrant. And then we just run some celery ribs over a grater and then cook it all in sugar. And you make almost like a mint simple syrup. Mm-hmm. You make a celery simple syrup. And it's great on, it's certainly great with bourbon, but it's great on everything. Like even just a dish of vanilla ice cream, it gives this sort of anise-like flavor to it. It's really appealing.
It's interesting, too, because people don't think of celery and sweetness as going together.
Right, right. But it is a very sweet, sweet sort of fennel-like flavor.
Let's talk about pickles, because this is something, you guys have been into pickles for a long time, but in this book it seems to like really reach the apex, and cucumbers hardly even make an appearance here.
Right.
That's right. Cucumbers, for one reason, and that's because in simple fresh Southern cooking, you have to quick pickle. This isn't the kind of pickling where you lay down for Armageddon in the basement.
It's not in the bomb shelter.
It's not in the bomb shelter. This is, and we never even go to the trouble of sterilizing the jars. I mean, we just want to keep them in the fridge, do small batches, not huge batches. We don't want to like make this seem like a major production. And we need to keep our vegetables thin. And so whether it's cucumber or in the case of the cookbook recipes, carrot, watermelon, you want to keep your vegetables very thin. And so you just pour hot brine over the vegetables already packed in the jar, and voila, that's it. And you just sort of push it to the back of the fridge for a couple hours. And that's enough time for thinly sliced vegetables to marinate and to absorb those wonderful flavors. You know, we're pickling for flavor more than preservation.
I'm really interested in doing a pickled grape.
Yes.
Right.
Well, that's
sort of the reverse of the celery situation, where you take something sweet and move it back into the savory realm.
I think we were looking for something to do with those, you know, Thompson seedless grapes that you find everywhere, but sort of have the flavor of sugar water, and yet they're ubiquitous, and it just seemed like a fun thing to try, and we did it with our first try was with chilies and rosemary and garlic. And just a half and half brine of vinegar and water. And it turned out really well because they take on the vinegar and they become something almost like an olive. We usually serve them at the cocktail hour just the same way you would an olive. And some people even, we didn't realize this, but some people look at them and think they're olives because we usually serve them, you know, red grapes and with green grapes just for varieties, for color. And then they pop them in their mouth and realize, oh, my gosh, there's no pit. This is not an olive. This is something completely different. But once you get over the surprise of it, it's a really appealing flavor. It's very sort of sweet, sour.
And it probably has a precedent. I mean, let's be fair, in the Mediterranean. And the, you know, rosemary and garlic are so associated with, you know, the warm Mediterranean climate and grapes as well. And I can't imagine that there weren't pickled grapes in Roman times.
Matt Lee and Ted Lee are my guests. Their new book is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern, Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. They're in town for a signing at Legacy Books in Plano tonight at 7. You can join the conversation now by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Ted Lee and Matt Lee. Their new book is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern, Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. I want to talk for a minute about seasons. And I think a lot of people think of southern food and they think it's something that's really good when it's hot out, but they don't think so much about the colder weather. Mm-hmm. Are there ways that southern dishes can be sort of adapted so that what you think of in the middle of the summer also works in December?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. But I do think that, you know, many of the root vegetable dishes that are classic southern dishes are all about winter. Mm-hmm. I think of turnips and rutabagas and beets and so I love celebrating those sorts of vegetables, even though our publisher doesn't think that, like, they don't want turnips in anything, basically. Publishers don't.
The word alone. Even if it tastes good, they just don't want that word.
But, you know, like a turnip gratin is a classic southern dish. Gingered beets. Mm-hmm. Gingered beets is a, you know, beautiful, beautiful treatment of winter vegetable.
Part of what we've tried to emphasize on the road, and especially outside the South, is something that people inherently know, even though they don't think about it, about the South, which is that it's a great place to grow vegetables, or anything, for that matter, compared to, say, New England or, you know, Minnesota. And another thing people don't realize is that there's really two seasons here, and the one we're in right now, November, throughout most of the South, is one of the best seasons, you know, to grow anything. Our farmers' markets are, you know, brimming over with everything because there's usually a second crop of tomatoes or peanuts or whatever. You know, the time that's not so great for vegetables and fruits is, you know, the dead of summer.
Mm-hmm. When everything's roasting
yeah,
on the vine.
Everything's withered.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bill in Richardson. Hey, Bill.
Hi. Hey, I wanted to ask your guest if they could comment about boiled peanuts. I was living on the Mississippi Gulf Coast one year, and I had never tried boiled peanuts until I got down there, and they're for sale on every little back road and state highway. Also, have they ever heard of deep-fried peanuts? I ran into those last week when I was out in Gun Barrel City, Texas, at a little convenience store. They had them wrapped up by some local cooker, and you can actually eat the shell with the peanuts, and they are delicious with the shell.
Wow. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, we love boiled peanuts. I mean, we got into this headed down this path because of boiled peanuts. We were just so outraged that they weren't available in New York City, because growing up in Charleston, South Carolina, they were everywhere. It's what you grabbed on the way to the beach or go out in the boat or to the minor league baseball game. I mean, very much associated with the outdoors. What's wonderful about boiled peanuts is that they are fresher peanuts than the peanuts we all, you know and love that are roasted. You know, you take a peanut, it's dug out of the ground. It grows under the ground like a potato, but it's a legume, like a bean. It's this very bizarre and interesting and wonderfully nutritious plant. But you take it out of the ground, and at that point, it's like a fresh vegetable, and you have to keep it refrigerated every step of the way. So it's a little harder for people who grow peanuts to sell those. They don't come into the marketplace that often because it's so much easier to dry them out and to roast them. Basically to, you know, bake them, and they acquire that nutty quality then, you know, before you roast them or fry them, which is basically like roasting. It brings out the same type of flavor. Before you do that, it has a bean-like flavor that really is true to that legume aspect of the plant. And that throws people for a loop, sort of like the pickled grapes. If they don't have never tasted boiled peanuts, peanuts in their raw state, you know, they just don't know how to process it because you see it. It looks like a peanut, but yet it doesn't taste like what you've grown up with and what you expect.
But boiled peanuts are really one of those regionalisms that makes the South such an exciting place to travel through, because really, as you know, I think more and more people are realizing that Southern food isn't just one huge monolithic thing that when you travel through the South, you know, you'll run into boiled peanuts round about, you know, northern Florida, and then you'll have them through Georgia on into South Carolina. But by the time you get to North Carolina, they're not there anymore. And, you know, in North Carolina, you've got the Eastern North Carolina barbecue, which is its own thing, which you, you know, and it's really, I think more and more people are discovering that as you can really travel through the South in the way you can Italy, where every region has its own set of ingredients and preparations and techniques. And it's really exciting to dig into that. And we love doing that.
Are people pretty territorial about, like, this is the way you do a boiled peanut? You know, don't listen to those Floridians.
Absolutely. That's part of the fun is, you know, some people say, you know, you only make boiled peanuts from freshly dug, you know, straight out of the ground. And they won't eat a boiled peanut that's made from, you know, just a sort of sun-dried peanut, or, you know, they'll only do it the traditional way. Some people put ham, like liquid smoke, in their peanuts. Some people put chilies in them. Vinegar and chilies. I've had vinegar and chili boiled peanuts. It's, you know, everyone has their own thing, and everyone thrills and, you know, passionately defends the one that they tend to grow up with.
Let's talk about smoking. You guys are really big on, not cigarette smoking, but on smoking food. You have stovetop smokers in both of your homes.
Right.
How do these work, and what's the advantage of having this over sort of doing it some other way?
They're very simple to work with. Matt, do you want to explain?
Sure. Well, at their basic heart, it's just a bus pan with a tin foil lid and a rack inside. That could be the most basic stovetop smoker.
So you can make your own, essentially.
You could make your own. We don't, you know, recommend it, but in a pinch, of course.
I would correct you in the sense that you said a bus pan, but when I think bus pan, I think of a plastic pan. It's more a roasting pan.
Right, a roasting pan. I'm sorry. Thank you. And the commercial version that you can buy at any cookware store looks like a roasting pan with a sliding metal lid instead of tin foil, and that's a nice convenience. But you basically place them over the burner with some granulated, you know, wood chips, sawdust, basically. They package it now in, you know, mesquite, apple wood. You know, some of the fruit woods are really nice, hickory, of course. And it's a very short cooking process. Our smoked shrimp that we have in the cookbook take maybe 6 minutes to smoke over, you know, direct flame. It produces, you know, nice hot smoked flavor with all the, you know, the aroma of a fireplace, basically, a barbecue. And it's a fun trick to do for, you know, simple weeknight, you know, gathering. It's a wonderful hors d'oeuvre.
Yeah, we do shrimp and trout, but we also we were inspired by a friend who was doing smoked mashed potatoes, and we thought, let's do smoked cauliflower. And what we do is we put the we blanch the cauliflower and then put the cauliflower on the rack in the pan, and it literally only takes 2 minutes or 3 minutes to take on so much flavor. And then we buzz it up in a blender with some butter and buttermilk, and it's kind of like the sleeper hit. I did it for Thanksgiving. And it was, everyone just loves it. You know, my 97-year-old grandmother-in-law, she was all about the cauliflower puree.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Matt Lee and Ted Lee are my guests. Their new book is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. When you smoke things, is there smoke all over the kitchen?
No. There's a certain amount, but only to good effect. I mean, it's aromatherapy.
You're not setting off the smoke alarm?
No, it's not like that. It takes place over such a short period of time that there really isn't, and there's so little combustible material that there really isn't time for clouds of smoke to develop.
When is a dish worth deep frying?
That's a very good question. Well, we do some frying in our household. I mean, our first book had tons of frying in it.
And there's a little bit in this cookbook as
well.
There
is a little bit of that in this cookbook.
There's no defense of lard in this one, though. I remember that being an element of the last cookbook.
The defense is implicit in this.
We do some frying here. Like, for example, we do a Caesar salad with catfish croutons. And in that, it's a traditional Caesar salad, but we cut up catfish fillet into 1-inch cubes and dredge it and fry it. And so the frying is more like an accent. Instead of the center of the plate. And it's great. We love frying. It's crispy. It does everything great. And we also actually have a recipe for fried green tomato pickle.
Yeah.
Fried pickles are, I don't know who invented fried pickles, but they're wonderful because they have that crispy crust and then that sour, wonderful interior. And we do that with our green tomato pickles. Frying is, you know, it's something, frying, all those southern techniques that sort of get a lot of flack for being unhealthy, we enjoy them in moderation. I mean, and I think that part of Simple Fresh Southern was to really focus on the fresh side, just to show that there are different ways of doing it, and that you know, you do everything in moderation. And certainly with lard, you know, we make pie crust with lard, but we're not eating pies every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
I want to talk about your ambrosia recipe, which sounds great. I haven't had a chance to make it yet. But you, like me, remember that being the name for something made with, like, shredded sugary coconut and marshmallow bits, sometimes in different colors. Yeah. This is not what you're making.
No. No canned mandarin orange.
Right, exactly.
Syrup in this one. you know, we loved the idea of that, of an ambrosia, even if we didn't always love the way it was prepared and turned out. And to us, it was often too sweet, you know, too much syrup and fruit. And we wondered if we could just pull it back a little more into the savory realm and add a bitterness component through parsley, you know, which has a nice sort of appealing, you know, bitterness is almost the wrong word, but it's a sharpness, a bite to it.
And you use flat leaf parsley here, right?
Flat leaf, yeah. Right, preferentially. And then also endive, sliced in a particular way into sort of like ribbons, like slivers, that's sort of a nice textural composition, but also reinforces that like bitter component because we do have citrus in it. It's a citrus salad at heart. And then it does have coconut, which we think is essential to an ambrosia. That's what makes it ambrosia.
But you use fresh coconut typically.
Yeah, if possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Weatherford, where we find Beverly. Hey, Beverly.
Hi there. How are y'all today?
Great, thank you.
Good.
I'm originally from Jackson, Mississippi, and you were talking about things that are near and dear to my heart. But I was wondering if you'd run into kulikles, and if maybe you had a version of a kulikle. Are you familiar with them?
I think I am. This is Matt talking now. You dip a pickle in like a Kool-Aid mixture, is that right? A powder?
Is that how you do it?
You drain off the... Hello, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, you drain off the pickle juice and you fill it with grape or cherry Kool-Aid.
Oh, that's right.
And they sit in that.
We read like an anthropological treatise about this behavior.
the kulikles or Kool-Aid pickles, where you dump out the vinegar... you dump out the brine and you replace it with Kool-Aid, so it's sort of sweet and sour. We passed through Jackson. We've just come up through Jackson a week or so ago and did not have a chance to try them. And we kept looking for them but didn't find them. But that's another one of those amazing regional things. It's all about that one part of Mississippi where Kool-Aid pickles are the tradition.
It makes a certain amount of sense because if you have a salty and sour pickle going on, you might want to add that element of sweetness. Whether you want the blueberry flavor, I don't know. But no, we haven't developed our own kulikle yet, but that's a great idea.
What are your publisher? If your publisher doesn't want turnips.
Well, the Purple Jesus made it through the ringer. So.
One thing I like about you all is that you seem to be fearless. Like you'll make anything once, you'll try anything once. When you go to these old recipes, do you off the top say, I'm going to change this and do that, or do you make them faithfully the first time and then think, what can we do?
No, I think in general we just go for our own interpretation. Mm-hmm. We'll just, I mean, even just from reading it, you can sort of be like, oh, I want to tweak this here and I want to try this. And it certainly doesn't always happen easily. I mean, there are sometimes, you know, we'll go through a sort of tweak that we're doing 12 times before we get it to a point where we're comfortable with it. And then we'll send it to a recipe tester who tests it from a home economy perspective and sort of, you know, feeds
it. We'll test it on our friends in sort of like, you know, party performance mode and see how it, how the guests react to it. We'll try to test it every which way. Hand it to our mom.
And are they all like, oh, my God, the ninth batch of whatever?
People love food. I mean, we're in a good business because, you know, by and large, people know how to relate to food. And we find that food is the best way to sort of, you know, meet people and get people talking and sharing, you know, stories. And I just always wonder what we'd have done if we had gone into the insurance business.
Are there certain things that people expect you to bring if you're going to their house? I'm guessing that you don't get off with just bringing a bottle of wine when you show
up. Right. Well, sometimes we don't bring boiled peanuts to a party, for example, and people are disappointed. And we'll say, yeah, but we brought this beautiful pimento cheese potato gratin. Aren't you excited about that? And usually they are. But usually, more and more, I'm trying to bring pickles because I really, really... not to go back to an earlier subject, but we have a lot of them around these days because we're quick pickling all the time. They're just so great and so versatile.
And they make a great gift. And traditionally, I think when our parents moved to Dallas, one of the first gifts they received was a big quart jar of pickled peaches or spiced peaches, sometimes people call them here. And it just seems to be, you know, a big jar of pickles is a great housewarming present, good, you know, scent. Good gesture of hospitality.
And they look so pretty, too.
Yeah, they do. You know, they've got that visual factor that's important in gifts.
Matt Lee and Ted Lee are my guests. They are in town for a book signing tonight at Legacy Books in Plano that takes place at 7. You can find information at legacybooksonline.com. The new cookbook is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. We'll resume our conversation in just a couple of minutes, and you can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Ted Lee and Matt Lee, authors of the new book, The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern Knockout Dishes with Down-Home Flavor. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. One thing that's interesting about you guys is that you've never actually worked in a restaurant kitchen. Everything for you is really based on home cooking. How do you think that makes your approach to food different than people who have been chefs professionally?
Well, I think we're just a little bit more sympathetic to the predicament of being in your own kitchen, an ingredient short, not understanding what the instruction in the recipe is telling you, and just having that element of doubt or anxiety hanging over you as you're working through a cookbook. You know, we're all mortal, and we've all just got the equipment we've got. And if you've decided to put a certain dish on the table tonight, you just have to work through it. And so what we've tried to do in both our cookbooks is to make sure that at least the recipe is solid. And people have described our recipe writing style as hand-holding, because we maybe even go overboard in describing the sights, the sounds, the smells, just so that you don't get to that point where you're wondering if you're on the right track.
Like, what is this supposed to look like right now? Those moments are anxiety are the kind of things we're trying to, you know, clear out of everyone's minds when we write our recipes.
Professional chefs, you know, it's so second nature to them. You know, they're professionals, and so they can't imagine that you'd have any doubt what you know you know, spatchcocking a chicken means or whatever, you know.
I hope to never know what that means.
But they also work in a sort of shorthand.
Yeah.
And we've discovered that because going on the road with the book, we'll do events where we partner with a restaurant. And it's really hard for two guys like us to step into a restaurant kitchen and know what's going on, because we just don't know. If they say, oh, we're going to do these in a 600 pan. What is a 600 pan?
The equipment is different. The language is
and
different.
And why doesn't it have a handle? And, but, you know, what? Where's the oven mitt? It's just a different arena of creativity. And I think, you know, Matt and I get so much inspiration from restaurant chefs, but gosh, could we never run a restaurant in our lives? I mean,
it would seem stressful to have all that great food going by so quickly for hours at a time, and you just got to sort of keep up with the pace
of
everything.
I mean, we treasure like every morsel, and it pains me to throw away the end of the onion without putting it in the stock pot, you know, to try to harvest that last flavor. You know, cooking from a home perspective is cooking, you know, with your budget in mind as well. It's just a totally different arena for creative expression and for, you know, feeding your family.
But I think it's also an arena for pleasure. And certainly the restaurant kitchen can be that. But I think it's a different sort of adrenaline kind of thing in a restaurant where, you know, for me, when I'm cooking, it's all about those, you know, those moments of, you know, beauty and grace that come about when you're just, you know, you're using that knife you love and you're cutting an onion that you just know is super fresh and sort of, you know, stringing together all these different moments where you're getting pleasure from actually creating it. And then you get to eat it too.
Do you guys shop every day before you cook?
Pretty much. I have a hard time thinking ahead, but I also like to let what I find in the stores and at the markets suggest what I'm going to cook mm-hmm. that night. I far prefer that approach. Ted actually seems to prefer going out there with the recipe in hand to the grocery store, but that's how our styles are different.
I love having a shopping list and getting it done and having my arsenal there.
And you don't deviate. You go in and buy what you meant, not...
That's absolutely true. And mm-hmm. if I don't find, as I didn't the other day when I was cooking Thanksgiving, if the store doesn't have parsnips, I have to go to another store and find the parsnips. Like, I can't just, like, I'm going to change my program thing. I'm sort of not very malleable in that sense.
I like to roll with it.
But I think that's the way, you know, Matt and I are we have very different styles of cooking. And I think that's one of the great things about the home kitchen is it's such a personal space. And especially in the South, I think it seems to happen more often in the South that people really have a reputation for a certain dish or a certain style of cooking. And I think that's really special.
Tell me about radish butter.
Radish butter. That was a dish that we had. It's a spread, you know, it's a basically a I think it's vegetarian if you eat butter. It's basically a compound butter of chopped radishes and butter that you spread on bread or crackers or celery and then sprinkle salt and pepper on. And it makes a great sort of vegetarian spread. And we were visiting a friend in Nashville who served it to us about 10 years ago. And I just thought we thought it was so delicious, so fresh. It was the height of summer. And at the same time, it just seems so simple. And we sort of... It actually was more difficult to develop than I thought because I didn't have the courage to ask our friend Mindy, can I steal your recipe?
Well, now she knows, right?
now she knows.
And we've given her credit. But it's sort of like, you know, the French dip radishes, breakfast radishes in butter and sort of sprinkle it with salt. And it's sort of like that, but it's, you know, it's easier on a guest because you just have to spread it. You know, you spread it on toast.
But it's one of these simple, like, country pleasures. She grew up in Tennessee. That have sort of disappeared from the southern landscape as people have become more urbanized and have, you know, lost a few pleasurable things along the way. And so it was fun to sort of resurrect that. And it seems so cosmopolitan, you know, radishes and butter. It's something that you might encounter in the streets of Paris. And yet it's, you know, wonderful, fresh flavors. The bite of the radish, which is sort of turnip-like, actually goes really well with butter and salt.
So So if you were allowed to include like turnip and rutabaga and things like that in the cookbook, are there things that you can sort of share with us that you would do with them?
Well, we actually, it was really in the last book that they said you cannot put your turnip and marjoram spoon bread in this book.
Because there's winter root vegetables in here.
Oh, plenty. Yeah. And oh, yeah. I think and we even sneaked some turnips through the
did.
Sensors.
We snuck in. We have a carrot and turnip slaw in this book, which is, you know, raw carrot, raw turnip, you know, shredded. And, you know, that was certainly a surprise that they work together and that they make such a great slaw, which is super addictive. What would we do with rutabagas? We don't have any rutabagas in this book.
I use them almost interchangeably with, you know, big turnips and other root vegetables. What I often do with root vegetables is combine them, the more sweeter ones like beets, with the more bitter ones. Although I ate very recently what was billed as an organic turnip that was it was as sweet as an apple and
really
delicious raw. I just started chopping it up for some other purpose and just out of curiosity tasted it, and it was fantastic. And so I blind tested it on my brother and our sister and other relatives, and they couldn't believe that it was a turnip. We just have such a wonderful wealth, especially nowadays. It's such a great time to cook Southern because people are awakening to the different varieties of vegetables. You know how you've got your early girl tomato and, you know, what are the other varieties of tomato?
Brandywine,
the German yellow, and et cetera. We have the same thing in turnips, you know, and we have the same thing in collards and kales as well. There are different varieties of these greens. There's not just one. And it's just fun to experiment and see what you find out. You may find that collards are delicious eaten out of hand.
Do you typically like to taste those raw ingredients first? Because I'm thinking of things like, you know, those root vegetables and even onions and garlic. And, you know, we use jalapenos here in Texas. And you don't know until you've tasted it how powerful and pungent
them.
It is.
You have to taste your chilies if you possibly can, even just a tiny little speck to see what you're working with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have a lot of fresh poblano chilies in the new book because we just love chilies, dried, fresh, whatever. And actually, we were testing the collards with poblanos and chorizo that's in this book, and I didn't test them beforehand, and we'd been using these ones that were super sweet, and whoa, it was scorching. I don't know where this poblano chili came from, but it was the most scorching poblano chili I've ever had. So we always try to encourage people to taste before you
know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Well, and to also, it's just a little distinction, but to taste at several times during the course of making a dish. People forget to do that. And to season in small increments frequently, many times throughout the course of making a dish, because, you know, you build up flavor much better that way. The flavors and the salt has a chance to meld and really permeate the dish, and you never, you know, you stand less a chance of going overboard.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than too much salt in something.
Right.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Maria in Weatherford. Hey, Maria.
Yes. I just wanted to mention I spent 15 years in the service, and throughout my 15 years, I traveled extensively, and my husband spent retired with 20, so you could imagine how many times we moved. But there are three things that bring comfort to us that we tried in the South. Obviously, collard greens, but the two different ones are pickled spicy dill green beans.
Right.
They were delicious. And jalapeno carrots. They blanched the carrots and put in the jalapeno juice. And it canned that way.
Yum.
No matter where we are, I have a friend that sends them to me, and it's like, we feel warm all over. It's like we're being back down in the South somewhere.
Oh, that's great. What a great description of the comforts of Southern cooking, too.
Yeah.
You have those things.
Yeah, food memories are just so powerful. And yeah, pickled green beans, like, what a great pickle. You know, it's finger food, and something about the flavors are just perfect together. But I also like the idea of combining carrots and jalapenos. See, right there is an idea, a combination that I just had never thought of before. You know, you sort of think that we're limited to, you know, just a handful of basic ingredients, like let's say 100 typical ingredients that we encounter in the grocery store and that we have in our pantry, and how many possible combinations are there? But the possibilities are infinite. I mean, there's plenty of territory to cover, even with if you were limiting yourself to 30 ingredients.
Is there anything you guys tried to pickle that just didn't work? Like, no matter how many times you did it, you thought, I cannot get the flavors right? Or does everything that you've tried sort of pickle well?
I think everything we tried went okay. I mean, we did adjust. We tried several different iterations of the pickled grapes, one with turmeric, one that was more, you know, a sweeter brine, different spicing and things like that. And we'll settle with one that we think, you know, flatters the grapes most. But no, I don't think there was anything that we didn't get super ambitious. You know, people say, gosh, you have so many pickle recipes, but we didn't try pig's feet or eggs or, you know,
that's for the next
book, I guess.
Pickled eggs are actually not that hard to make.
Love pickled
they
eggs.
They aren't.
Love pickled eggs.
And you now see them all over this country. I mean, in Maine, you know, you'll be at a truck stop and there'll be pickled eggs.
What do you guys do for Christmas?
Usually a big, we sort of like Thanksgiving, we tackle a big protein. and it's usually not
turkey.
Does
this include hunting it and shooting it? You are from the South.
Yeah, we've got the rhino roast. No, it's, you know, crown roast of pork I'm feeling maybe this time around. You know, that's a great presentation and there's something about it that seems epic. A couple of years ago, I did a goose, and that's a wonderful sort of, you know, antiquated Christmas entree that's really fun to try if you have a good source.
I'll do a fresh ham, but usually past few years, I've been with my wife's family in Naples, Florida, which is sort of a challenge culinarily. And they love for me to cook low country style, so I'll do shrimp and grits on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. And that's always fun, sort of like the caller described. Whenever you have a flavor of some place outside of its context, it's always such a great, you know, surprising homecoming.
What's your favorite thing for someone else to cook for you?
Pretty much anything. I mean, we're going to be in Austin tomorrow, and we stay with friends wherever we go. And our friends host asks us, you know, where do you want to go for dinner? Or I'd be happy to cook at home for you. And we always take that option. Please cook for us. We just love it. It's just a wonderful expression of friendship and fun.
I would agree. I think as a traveling, you know, we travel so often and we're cooking so often that I think for any chef to be cooked for is just such a thrill. I will say though that since we do so much Southern cooking, it's really fun to land in a place that's known for amazing sushi or something.
The new cookbook by Matt Lee and Ted Lee is called The Lee Brothers Simple Fresh Southern Knockout Dishes with Down Home Flavor. The book signing event tonight at Legacy Books takes place at 7 p.m. Guys, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.